Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. Vicky Gonzalez is on assignment today. The pulse oximeter. It somewhat sounds like something from the movie Back to the Future, does it not? But it's a very common medical device. It's that clip the nurse or doctor puts on your finger to measure the level of oxygen in your blood. Simple, painless, yet an important measure of what's going on inside. However, there is concern about the pulse oximeter's effectiveness during evaluating patients of COVID-19, especially for Black patients. And now we are learning about how bias in the device could have led to hours-long delays in patients with darker skin tone getting the care they needed. Important, considering that according to the Journal of the American Medical Association, although Black individuals represent 13% of the U.S. population, they account for 20% of COVID-19 cases and 23% of COVID-19-related deaths. So this study of the pulse oximeter's effectiveness was led by researchers at Sutter's Institute for Advanced Health Equity and conducted in collaboration with the Roots Community Health Center in Oakland and UC San Francisco. Joining us today are Kristen M.J. Azar, Scientific Medical Director with Sutter, and Dr. Noha Abolada, CEO of Roots Community Health Center. And a big thank you to both of you for helping our audience understand this research and then its significance.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. So for context, and I'm not sure which one of you would be best to do this, but if you could explain how the pulse oximeter measures oxygen content in a person's blood so we can have a sense of how this works.
Sure. Do you want to go ahead, Dr. Blada?
Well, it uses infrared light that goes through the skin. And so if there is anything there competing, which melanin, as it turns out, does, then it will sort of interfere with the ability to get an accurate reading.
So, Dr. Abolada, I assume this is important when it comes to COVID because of how the virus affects the lungs. And how does the device determine the line of care then that a patient would get?
Well, the pulse ox reading was actually the objective criteria that was used to decide whether someone would even get taken to the hospital by an ambulance. It was the advice we were giving people at home to decide when they should bring themselves to the emergency room. And then in the emergency room, it was used to determine whether a person should receive oxygen, treatment, or even be admitted to the hospital. So it was actually the one sort of objective reading that was used to determine all of the care that then followed.
And we say objective, but now it looks like it wasn't so objective.
Exactly. It's flawed. And so although it may appear to be, you know, an objective thing that a doctor could look at, we now know that it is compromised and it may be responsible for folks who got sent home to die or people who died at home or who were not, you know, were not treated in a timely manner.
So your study and analysis in a nutshell found that this device overestimated the amount of oxygen in the blood of Black patients, signaling, of course, that they may not be in as bad of shape as non-Black patients. And so it all comes down to the melanin blocking the device's ability to read the oxygen levels?
That's right. So it's actually kind of a gradient. And so this could be really any non-white skin, and the darker the skin tone, the less accurate the device.
Uh-huh. New versions of Apple Watch and Fitbits, as well as other wearables, also track blood oxygen levels. Do we know if they show similar faulty results when it comes to skin tone? I assume they use the exact same technology.
I think this is a big question about really thinking about how we conduct research and clinical research and thinking about the importance of diversity in our patients that we enroll in clinical trials and clinical studies to really understand, as we develop these devices, how they may differentially work in different populations.
Right. Director Azar, let's dig into the findings of the study a little bit. How does your analysis show this could have affected the care for darker skinned patients?
Well, I think the main point here is that given that the pulse oximeter value essentially means something different for Black patients compared to those with lighter skin, it was harder for clinicians to appropriately treat Black patients suffering from COVID-19. And that resulted in measurable treatment delays, and it contributed to the structural racism in healthcare, regardless of clinician intent. So the central role that the pulse ox played in clinical decision-making made it really challenging for patients to really get the care that they needed, specifically Black patients, given the darker skin and the systematic overestimation of oxygen.
Mm-hmm. I see a statistic here that I believe was provided by the study showing that the increased time to supplemental oxygen treatment was, I imagine this is an average of 4.5 hours, which is really critical with how that virus, especially in the early versions of it, were just decimating people's bodies.
Absolutely. And I think it's important to note that the pulse oximeter is used in more conditions beyond COVID-19. It's sometimes used as a way to reimburse for supplemental oxygen in the home. We were having patients within the context of COVID-19 have the pulse ox at home to think about when was appropriate to come to the hospital. So it became a really important tool that many were relying on in thinking about coming in. And it also resulted in many patients actually being sent home when they otherwise may have been admitted if their pulse ox had been 1 or 2% higher based on the device. And so that may have contributed as well to delays in treatment and worsening of conditions when they finally did get treated or come or presented later on to the hospital.
Director Azar, are you surprised at all by the findings?
The sad reality is that this issue is actually not new. There's been documented evidence of a higher level of inaccuracy of pulse oximeters for dark-skinned individuals for literally decades. I think what brought this issue back to the forefront in recent times is the central role that it played in the recommendations and treatment guidelines for COVID. And we and many others early on detected the disparities that were emerging within the pandemic around outcomes. And so I'm actually not surprised to find that this is one piece maybe of a bigger puzzle of how systemic and structural racism may play into the differential outcomes that we were seeing and we still see in terms of the pandemic.
Dr. Abolata, COVID, of course, is still around, as are several other conditions that would affect someone's blood oxygen level. What can Black patients take away from this study and, you know, this information? Is there a way that they can then use that to say, hey, well, that reading, you know, the reading might have come back like that, but it's not an accurate reading?
There's a couple of things that we've been recommending to patients, and I just want to caveat it all by saying it's completely inadequate. We need this to be fixed. But in the meantime, what we are recommending is that patients actually establish their own baseline when they're feeling well, because we're at least hopeful that changes in the pulse oximeter value will still be instructive and still say, you know, if you're normally 99 and now you're 95, that may read as normal or not meet the criteria for admission, but it is very significant in that it's a 4-point drop. And then we're actually, believe it or not, telling people to take the study with them to the emergency department to make sure that their physicians are aware, because this, you know, this is something that is unfortunately not well known. And I'll remind us all that there was a point in the pandemic where our hospitals didn't have enough beds. And so decisions with limited resources were being made in response to this device. And so we're really asking people to get informed and advocate for themselves. But I think the sad fact is that this is just one example of how structural, you know, problems lead to disparities. And we have an issue where the death disparity, I mean, here in Alameda County, African-Americans are dying at more than double the rate of everyone else. And that gap is actually widening when we, you know, also look at things, you know, that put people at higher risk of contracting COVID-19. So this is not an issue that's behind us, unfortunately, and it really needs to be addressed.
Are any of the makers of this device suggesting ways that it could be improved so that this isn't a problem?
Well, we know that it's possible, and we know that it's, you know, probably, you know, going to take a little bit more resources to make a device that basically can work on all skin tones. And so you mentioned, you know, some of the Apple Watch devices and things like that, that use software and other things. And so I think we have not heard, I have not heard anything that, you know, suggests that this is going to be fixed by the manufacturers, but it's 2022. We have adequate technology and this has to be fixed because the only alternative now is a quite painful procedure of taking blood from the inside of the wrist out of an artery and waiting, again, losing more precious time in order to get a confirmation. And it's just simply unacceptable in 2022 to say, well, if you have darker skin, you're going to have to do a painful procedure in order for me to get accuracy.
Mm-hmm. Director Azar.
I was just going to add to that. I do believe the FDA is meeting around this issue in November, which is very encouraging. And I think our study adds to mounting evidence and mounting, making a compelling case to really evaluate this at the policy level, specifically around the pulse oximeter and how we can do better with our standards and really thinking about holding our entire system more accountable for knowing that this is a real phenomenon. I mean, we confirmed it with our own data in terms of the systematic overestimation, and that's different for darker skin patients. And so I'm encouraged that that some change will hopefully take place in the future as we and others continue to report on this and really appreciate your help in really getting the word out.
We're happy to do it. And I'm thinking that there are many people listening right now who are affected by this and maybe not necessarily on along the COVID lines. And so you had mentioned, Director Azar, that there are other illnesses where this might be an issue. Could you go down a few of those so that people listening might, you know, have a light bulb and bring this to the attention of their doctor the next time they go in?
Absolutely. So any respiratory condition that may require supplemental oxygen in their home, so emphysema, COPD, congestive heart failure, any condition where you are relying on oxygen or would benefit from supplemental oxygen, really have that conversation, especially if you're concerned that the pulse oximeter readings are inaccurate, because it may be really crucial in thinking about reimbursement and being able to have those resources that you need to have high quality of life and to be able to manage your condition.
Yeah, I want to remind everyone, you're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about a new study revealing that the device used to measure how much oxygen is in your blood could have caused delays in care and treatment, specifically for darker skinned people, Black patients, while being evaluated for COVID-19. Dr. Abolata, you are quoted as saying, in regards to this study, it's time we all demand technology that doesn't discriminate. Can you unpack that for us?
Absolutely. I think that, I mean, this is a contemporary perfect example of systemic racism in healthcare. And so for folks who aren't sure that that exists, I think this is a good example to show that, like Director Azar said, this has actually been known, was discovered decades ago and was never addressed. That is completely unacceptable and has now led to an untold number of deaths and disability. And so I think it's really important that we don't just try to, you know, make a corrective calculation or something like that, but we actually go back to the drawing board and say, this was a mistake. These are devices that should never have been approved. They made it through the approval process without having to go through their diligence of ensuring that it worked on everyone. And in this country, with all of the other biases, whether they are explicit or implicit, and all of the other reasons why we have, especially African-American patients, not able to trust the healthcare system, this is a great example of why that has happened. And so I think it's really incumbent upon us to make sure that all of the policies, procedures, devices, and this is really a device that is assessing a vital sign. So for us to have a vital sign that we cannot rely upon and that is steering healthcare professionals in the wrong direction is completely unacceptable.
Yeah, I mean, imagine if a basic thermometer didn't work, you know, based on your skin tone. I would hope that that would be addressed immediately. So I'm thinking that this starts at the drawing board phase, right? At the very, very beginning, when the technology industry and the medical industry are coming up with new devices to help, these aspects should be considered then, correct?
Absolutely. I think we're going to have to take a really good look at the device industry and see and the device approval process and ensure that just like we saw with clinical trials for the vaccine, where we all wanted to see good representation of different racial and ethnic groups in the trials, we need to do the same exact thing for devices. So it should not be acceptable to actually have a device cleared without demonstrating that it has adequate representation in the clinical trials.
And Director Azar, we should mention you're with Sutter Health again, founded in Sacramento, now one of the largest healthcare providers in Northern California. In your work with the Institute for Advancing Health Equity, you have also uncovered other inequities in medicine. What are you working on now?
Yeah, no, thanks for that. I mean, we are definitely on a journey within Sutter Health. We have been doing work to understand and address disparities and to achieve health equity for years, and recently established our institute in December 2020. We're focused now really on understanding ways that we can create a dialogue around moving us all forward around unconscious bias mitigation healthcare settings. We're partnering with the California Medical Association, the California Primary Care Association, and the Physicians for Healthy California to co-host a symposium on October 14th. It'll be a virtual symposium open to all, and bringing in some wonderful speakers, policymakers, clinicians, community leaders, and scientists to really talk about the state of the science around unconscious bias mitigation in healthcare. So we're hoping to really be at the forefront of really thinking about how we can do better, you know, together as a community, as a society in these issues.
And are you feeling that shift on any level?
I do. I think there's a momentum growing. I think it's encouraging to see that, you know, we're just one team in a kind of a movement of other teams that are working to look at these things and bring them to the forefront. And we're partnering. I think that's really where the future is thinking about partnering, because together we're stronger. And so I feel like the pandemic really did allow for a renewed interest in understanding why these disparities have persisted for decades and how we can move from just continuing to report on the same disparities that we see and being reactive to now being proactive and trying to do something about it and really close those gaps. So we at Sutter are on that journey as well and hope to be part of that solution.
Well, thank you both for getting this data out there so that people understand that there is this flaw and it's not isolated. You just heard Kristen M.J. Azar. She's the scientific medical director with Sutter Health's Institute for Advancing Health Equity. Thank you so much again.
Thank you so much for having us.
And also Dr. Noha Abolada is CEO of Roots Community Health Center in Oakland, correct?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you again, both of you. Okay, so up next, we'll take you on a tour of, now, you don't have to hold your nose for this, it's Sacramento's regional sewage facility, where a massive upgrade is set to go online in the coming months, helping the environment and adding some relief for farmers during this drought. We'll also learn a bit about how the sewage they treat can provide early warnings for new COVID variants and potential surges, as well as other diseases, too. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You are listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, in for Vicky Gonzalez today. One of the largest public work projects in Sacramento history has been quietly underway out of sight for most people in the region. And starting next month, big portions of it are expected to go online, drastically changing how one, I guess you could say, dirty aspect of our lives is handled. That's the sound of sewage or wastewater being treated at the regional sand facility in Elk Grove. Now, if you live in Sacramento County, or for that matter, West Sacramento in Yolo County, there is a good chance the toilet you flushed this morning or yesterday is already being processed at this facility. On an average day, 150 million gallons of wastewater is handled at regional sand. Now, a massive $1.6 billion upgrade to the system called Echo Water is about to start cleaning sewage to the point that it can be used to irrigate ag crops. Yesterday, I took a tour of the Echo Water facility and sat down with Regional San and Sac Sewer General Manager Christoph Dobson, who helped explain a bit more about this big change that's more than a decade in the making.
Echo Water is the project that we've been building. It's an upgrade that came out of some regulatory requirements that we had back in 2010. And it's about a $1.7 billion project to upgrade our treatment plant to tertiary and advanced treatment. So it removes ammonia from our wastewater and then also filters the water to a very high degree. So that water is going to be so clean that we can use it to water food crops.
And this is the second largest project of its kind in the U.S.?
Yes, the one larger is Blue Plains in Washington, D.C.
For a little bit of history, the cities throughout the Sacramento region all used to treat their own water. And then at one point, everything got funneled to here?
Yeah, there used to be 22 smaller plants spread around the region. And they discharged primarily into the American River. And those were all taken offline. And we centralized and built this big plant here near Elk Grove.
So what's the farthest away someone might be where they're, you know, taking a shower or using the facilities and that water that's going down their drain at their residence ends up here?
Probably somewhere up in Folsom would be the farthest point, and it takes about a day for the wastewater to get from Folsom down here.
For somebody in Elk Grove, it's more like maybe a half a day or something, and it's already here?
Yeah, it might be just a few hours.
And most of that is pushed through the system naturally through gravity?
Yeah, most of our system is gravity flow, so it just uses gravity to flow downhill. But eventually it gets to a point that's maybe very deep under the ground, and we have to lift it up. So we use a pump station to do that, and it pressurizes the wastewater, pushes it to a place where gravity can then take over again.
Infrastructure is something that is sometimes right in our faces with like freeways and bridges and mostly transportation type things. And then you have this hidden infrastructure that is such a big part of our lives. Do you ever think, I just wish people realized how much is going on behind the scenes with all of this?
Sure. We've been in this business for a long time and understand that people don't see it, so they don't necessarily think about it. But that doesn't mean it's not important. It's very important infrastructure underground. And then also our treatment plant site is kind of tucked out of the way as well. And it has a buffer lands around that plant. So a lot of people don't see that either. But obviously it's very important. If you flush your toilet, you know how important it is.
Much of the water that is treated ends up in the Sacramento River, correct?
Yes, that's where our discharge point is.
And then some of the water that's treated ends up in a purple pipe system, it's called, that helps water some of the parks in Elk Grove.
Yes, so the purple pipe system is recycled water. We treat that to a very high degree, and then that water is safe to be used. Currently, it's used for ball fields and medians and some parks and things like that.
And some of that water is currently moving up into Sacramento for a SMUD facility that will no longer be used. Is there a plan to get some of that water to some of the parks in Sacramento?
That is a potential future. Right now, the water flows north to the Campbell Cogen facility, and it's used as cooling water. but there can be spurs. It was designed to have spurs coming off of that line into parks and other green areas within the city of Sacramento.
How much of that purple pipe water is produced? Like, is there capacity to water parks throughout Sacramento?
Right now, we have a facility that's generating about 3 million gallons per day. That's a very small facility that's on our plant site. But when Echo Water is complete, which is the end of this year, spring of next year, then our entire discharge will be available for recycled water. And that's on the order of 130 million gallons per day on average.
How much of the water of that Echo Water could be diverted from the Sacramento River without disrupting that ecosystem too much? Because I imagine at this point that water has been going in there for such a long time that it adds to the flow.
Right. The water that's discharged right now, it's primarily seen as additional flow in the river. And so we have specific requirements in order to get our water rights to move the discharge point to use it elsewhere. We had to go through a process that effectively asks all the downstream water users, what are your comments on this facility? So we've gone through that process and we have the water rights to do that. But there are certain times with our harvest water project, our bigger project to recycle water and send it south, where we will have to curtail the water deliveries and make sure that some of that water is going into the river.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the harvest project. So these are farmers that are in the San Joaquin Valley?
Sacramento, Southern Sacramento County.
Uh-huh. Oh, so it's still all within the county?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And like, what scale are we talking about? And how does the water get to them?
So we will be building a large transmission line and a pump station to pump the water south. The amount of water is typically in water, we say acre feet. So it's about 50,000 acre feet per year. And that water will be used by the farmers to water their crops. And in exchange, they will significantly reduce the pumping of the groundwater. And that's the big benefit, is that allows the groundwater to recover.
Your system won't only be helping farmers when it comes to water. Currently, they get pellets that are made from some of the solid waste that passes through here that is really high-grade fertilizer, isn't it?
Yeah, we have a partnership with Synagro. It's a private company, and they take about 30% of our solids, and they create a very high-quality fertilizer with that, and it's used to fertilize crops.
You have influent that's coming in from throughout the region. What is it, 1.6 million customers?
Correct, 1.6 million customers.
Uh-huh. And there are things that get tossed into the toilet or what have you that, or maybe even in Sacramento's case, at least in the grid area, might wash down the storm sewers. What is the biggest headache for you here when it comes to stuff that's coming in these four large pipes from people's homes?
Well, obviously anything that you're not supposed to flush down the toilet. We have some basic messages. One is wipes. Those wipes, they sometimes call flushable, but they're really not, because they are almost indestructible and they clog up pumps and other systems. We also want customers to not discharge fats, oils, or grease into their system, because if you put that down the drain, it will solidify and clog up either their sewer or our portion of the sewer, and that'll cause sewer overflows. Mm-hmm. So those are the primary ones. We also recommend or ask people not to flush any medications down the drain, because that's also something that isn't well treated at our treatment plant.
Throughout the different stages of the treatment process, water is sampled and then goes to a lab that you have here on site. And how many different tests are done annually?
We do about 90,000 tests annually. And those tests are for compliance with our regulatory requirements. They're also to help our plant make sure that the process is working right. And that's the bulk of the tests.
Are you able to test for concentrations of medications and that sort of thing?
We certainly can. Depends on what it is that you're testing for. We may send that out to another lab as well.
Mm-hmm. And you do send things out to other labs when it comes to testing for pathogens that are in the water that might cause things like
COVID-19 or monkeypox and that sort of thing. Walk us through that a little bit. How does that process work?
Sure. So first of all, pathogens, some pathogens we do test for here, but in particular, there's a science called wastewater-based epidemiology, and that's where you take the wastewater, sample it, send it off to a lab. We work with Stanford and also with a private company called BioBot. They take those samples and they test for specific diseases like COVID, and they can get a sense of the concentration in the wastewater. And that can tell you whether the cases may be going up or coming down. So you can see trends from that.
And Christoph, how accurate has this sampling been when it comes to tracking the disease?
It's accurate, not on an individual basis, but on an overall. So a good sense of what is the community, those 1.6 million people, you know, what level of is the pandemic in right now? How many people are being affected by it? So we get a sense of the trend.
And you mentioned that there is not just COVID or monkeypox. Do you also look at like flu transmission and things like that to see where we are in that season?
That's not something that we do. Stanford has been changing what diseases they look for. Flu is certainly something you could do. It's been used for polio in the past, and actually that's where wastewater-based epidemiology started, was when they were trying to get a handle on the polio epidemic.
This is a really large property. How many acres are we talking about?
A little over 3,000.
And a big chunk of that looks like open space. What is that land used for?
Right. So we have about 1,000 acres of process area and a little over 2,000 acres of buffer lands. And that area is just really a natural wildlife preserve. We have staff that actively manage that property. And its primary purpose is obviously to make a home for the flora and fauna, but it's also so that we can be good neighbors to the surrounding community. So it cuts down on the noise and the dust and the odors that come from an operating treatment plant.
You were very nice. You and your team were very nice to give me a tour of the facility. And one thing I noticed on the tour is that it really didn't smell that bad. And I've actually toured other wastewater facilities and I've, you know, driven past some where, you know, you can really smell it. How do you keep a handle on that?
Right. Odor complaints are a very important part of our job. We try to obviously limit those. And we do that by having covered processes, for one thing. And then we have odor removal equipment that is specifically designed to remove those odors. So it is, it smells pretty darn good here at the wastewater treatment plant.
You mentioned the land that's the buffer zone that's out there. There are not public trails because there are security concerns here, right? And there is a security gate when you come in and that sort of thing. What is the main concern security-wise?
Well, a wastewater treatment plant is essential infrastructure, so it's something even the federal government has recognized as critically important. If something happened to this plant, you could have a catastrophe with raw sewage going into the river. So it's very important that we keep this facility functioning, and therefore the security is necessary.
Mm-hmm. But you do offer some like guided tours from time to time?
Yeah, we do have our Bufferland staff has tours of various parts of the bufferlands. Roughly once a month or so, they'll have an event. We have in the springtime, our big event is the Walk on the Wild Side, which was shut down during COVID. We just started it back up this past year. And that's an opportunity for people to get out and walk on the trail a little bit as well.
We're about a year now from a major, unusual October storm that dumped record amounts of rain in the Sacramento region. How does your facility deal with that when such a large increase of water comes in? Because while most of the systems that feed into this plant are wastewater only, some of the water coming from Sacramento also includes stormwater.
Right. The city of Sacramento has a combined sewer system, which means both stormwater and wastewater. And so we do get very large flows in the wintertime, especially like that storm that you mentioned. And when that happens, we have very large storage basins that can essentially store that flow. And then when the flows come down a little bit, then we can put it back through the system.
Should I say a happy Wastewater Worker Week. Is that what it is? I believe this week is something special.
Yes, it's Wastewater Professionals Appreciation Week. And so we're doing a lot internally to appreciate our employees, but we're also doing some external stuff to let folks know how important water and wastewater workers are.
So everyone who's listening right now, when you use the facilities at some point today, and you will, keep that in mind that there are people that are hard at work making sure that all of this sewage throughout the region passes through and then into the river in a really clean and ecological fashion.
Yes, that is our mission, to protect public health and the environment.
Well, Christoph Dobson, thank you so much for your time today. And again, I very much appreciate the tour and getting a look at the facility. It is far larger than anyone probably imagines, because you can't really see it from any roadway.
Yes, it's very impressive. Thank you very much.
Christoph Dobson, their general manager at Regional San Sacramento Area Sewer District, telling us more about the virus tracking partnerships and then some of the big upgrades set to go online just within a month or so. Okay, still ahead, for more than a decade, Sacramento native Tim McCord has been a musician with the rock band Evanescence. He joins us ahead on a homecoming performance at the Aftershock Festival this weekend in Discovery Park. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we are back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
And welcome back to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, in today for Vicky Gonzalez, who is on assignment. Sacramento's Aftershock Music Festival really continues to grow. There was a blip, of course, during the pandemic, but it extended to 4 days starting last year and kicks off this year on Thursday at Discovery Park. According to Visit Sacramento, the rock music festival generates millions of dollars for the local economy, injecting a boost as concertgoers, of course, descend on the capital, the state capital. Tim McCord, the guitarist for Evanescence and a proud Sacramentan, I assume he's a proud Sacramentan, we all are, right? Joins us now to discuss his journey as a Sacramento musician and the upcoming Aftershock performance. Thanks for joining us today, Tim.
Hey, thank you, Randall. How are you?
Good. Did I get that right? You're a proud Sacramentan?
Oh, big time. Yeah, I love it. I love Sacramento, NorCal, everything about it, really.
Yeah, that's great. So you're from here. Tell us about your musical journey growing up here. And, you know, I assume you performed at a lot of the local venues, perhaps Colonial Cafe?
Never Colonial Cafe, but starting from, you know, the mid-90s to the mid to late 2000s, pretty much every venue you can think of. You know, back in the 90s, there was the old Cattle Club that became Bojangles, the Crest Theater, the Boardwalk. There was a pool hall in Old Sac called Scratch 8 for a while that used to host a lot of local shows, so did a lot of shows there. And really, whatever venues were available back in the day.
Yeah.
I've played Capitol Garage was another big one.
Oh, right. Yeah. I believe Bojangles was just right around the corner here from us at Sac State. Wasn't it right off of Folsom down here?
Yeah. Folsom Boulevard, sort of like kind of tucked in under the underpass a little bit, kind of wave everything.
Right. So you recently switched which instrument you play in the band Evanescence, going from playing bass to being lead guitar. So tell us a little bit about that change.
Well, I grew up, I started out as a guitar player, so it kind of wasn't a huge change for me. It wasn't like I had to learn a new instrument or whatever. I know, like, I started playing when I was maybe 16, playing guitar, and then played in a handful of local bands throughout the years. And then, I think I was about 25 or 26, where I got a random phone call from Evanescence manager saying, "Hey, is this Tim?" "Yes, it is." "Well, how would you like to play bass for Evanescence?" And I thought it was a joke.
Right.
Like, I had never met anybody in the band. I had never seen them live before. I didn't know really anything about the band other than they were a massive, very popular rock band, and kind of at the height of the very first album that was a smashing success. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, well, that's interesting. Why me and why bass? Because at the time I was a guitar player. And he let me know at the time that I had got a recommendation to him by a booking agent when I did one show in LA in a band I was briefly in called Quitter, where I was the bass player. But a booking agent was there in the audience that decided, hey, that guy's pretty good, and remembered me for a recommendation later on when Evanescence was looking for a bass player. So I got the phone call for that. I flew down to LA to do sort of an audition, which was just me sitting in a room with the band and talking to them like we're sitting here talking now.
Right.
And I just sort of hung out with them for about 20 minutes and just, talked to them like I would talk to anybody. And I got the job to become their bass player.
How wild is that, Tim? So it was somewhat of a one-off, that you're doing this performance as a bass player. This influential person sees you and it changes everything for you over the last decade or more.
Totally random. Totally random. Never in a million years would I have thought that something like that happened to me, but it did. And 17 years later, I'm still here. I was always a guitar player before, but I put the guitar away to play bass for this band. And, 16, almost 17 years later, we lost one of our guitar players, and we had a mutual friend named Emma, who is now our bass player, who also does background vocals. And we were deciding like who can fill in and take over the role of backup singer. And we thought of her.
Uh-huh. Emma Anzai with the band Sick Puppies. Uh-huh.
Yes. But she's a bass player. And so what was the only logical option was to move me over to play guitar, and mm-hmm. she can play bass. And so that's what we've been doing for the last 6 months now or so.
And just before that transition, the band dropped an album titled The Bitter Truth. So you did not play lead guitar on the recording of that album, or you did?
I didn't play any guitar on The Bitter Truth. I played all the bass, though.
Uh-huh.
I played some guitar on our album that was released in 2011, though.
Yeah.
Just not around. Yeah.
So people that are going to the festival on Thursday to see you, might they hear a different interpretation of songs from the album where you're now, you're now the lead guitarist?
Yes, yes. I mean, we play the music true to the albums usually, mm-hmm. but live performance, live rock and roll is a different thing. It's live. You get caught up in the moment. You throw things in that aren't there.
It's the whole reason to go to a concert, right?
I play with a slightly different feel than what's on the record. And Troy, the other guitar player, I'm sorry, the other guitarist, and I, we have a few moments where we set aside to like, okay, right here we're going to do something really cool. That's uh-huh. Or not planned out or all of that. So it's definitely a different feel, not only with me playing guitar as well, but with Emma playing bass, because she's not playing everything exactly the way that I did. So the live show versus the album, in my opinion, is really, really interesting. The band sounds very strong. The stage show is very strong. I feel like it's a very good representation of what the band is now.
Well, Amy Lee just has that signature voice that, you know, once you hear it, you never forget it. And I'm wondering, Amy has now been with the band longer than anyone else. You are now second in line for that title.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I'm the band member that has been around the longest.
Wow, that's impressive. For guitar nerds out there, what are you now playing as the lead guitarist?
Well, I'm playing mostly ESP guitars. I have a representative named Tony Rouser, who's a great guy. I mean, when we made this decision to change the band lineup and put me on guitar, I had to scramble. I had, I think, maybe 2 weeks to find a bunch of gear and have it shipped to Europe to meet me when that's where the first tour kicked off. Pardon me, with me on guitar. So I got in touch with Tony and, you know, what can you do? And I got set up with, I think, 10 ESP guitars. And I also have five or six Gibson guitars just from the past that I also use. So out there, I think I'm using 15 different guitars for our show or for our set lists. And for an amplifier, I've gone digital. Uh-huh. I use the quintessential Marshall stacks and all that. But right now I'm using a device called a Neural DSP Quad Cortex, which is it's a digital amp simulator, but the tone is huge and massive and heavy. And the whole thing is about this big.
And so he's showing me right now, it's like, what, like maybe a foot wide by 6 inches tall or something.
Smaller than a shoebox.
Yeah, and like a shoebox, yeah.
It's only a few pounds, mm-hmm. and sounds incredible. Sounds amazing. The folks that are lucky enough to come out to the show on Thursday night will get a taste of that.
And there were some people listening that knew what you were talking about there. You know, that were able to zero in on that, I'm certain. Hey, your Evanescence is planning a national tour that kicks off in the spring, right? The spring of 2023?
Yeah. Yeah. I got the news for that a couple weeks ago. We're taking off, and I think it's almost 7 weeks supporting the band Muse, which is one of my wife and mine, our favorite bands.
Oh, cool.
Well, she walked down the aisle to a Muse song at our wedding.
So, right.
Having that happen, going out and playing with those guys for, you know, a couple of months is really exciting. Going to be great.
Well, Tim, speaking of favorite bands, there's a really impressive lineup for Aftershock this year. Are there any performances that you're excited to catch?
There are so many bands and so many friends over those 4 days. I mean, I could sit here and list every band that I think is great that I want to see. We'd be here for a long time, but on our day, on Thursday, there's Slipknot. We're buddies with them. I'll be watching them. They're always really fun to see.
And you two are the headliners, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. On the main stage, we're the last two acts to go on, I think, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And there's sort of this grunge revival band called Super Bloom from New York, who's going on earlier in the day, and they put out easily my favorite record of last year. It just sounds straight like it's from 1993. It sounds like this grunge rock, that a sound that the world hasn't heard for quite a while. So uh-huh. It was kind of refreshing, nostalgic to hear a band playing that kind of music.
Hey Tim, just briefly, in about a minute or less, you know, this event, it keeps growing, and it's going to bring an estimated $30 million into the city and the region. What are your thoughts on rock music being the driving force behind such an economic boost? You know, when I was a kid, it was the jazz festival here in Sacramento. Now it's rock music that's making all the headlines.
Yeah, I remember the jazz festival. That was all pretty fun. Rock music sort of took a nosedive over the last decade or so, and I'm really, really glad that it's on the uptick now. Aftershock Festival and Danny Wimmer Presents. They do such a great job with everything. And Danny has a knack for picking out every awesome rock band that is currently active.
Yeah.
So it brings rock fans or metal fans, heavy music fans from all over the state, all over the country. You know, I've seen people on the internet talking about flying over from, different countries even. So it brings folks.
It's international. Yeah. Tim, I want to thank you so much, and I want to wish you the best of luck. I know you don't need it, but best of luck on Thursday, and here's to a successful festival. Thank you for joining us today on Insight.
Oh, no problem. I appreciate it. Good to be here.
Tim McCord, the guitarist for Evanescence and a proud Sacramentan, he said it himself, they'll be performing on Thursday at Aftershock. Thank you to our producers, Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, and managing editor, RM Sarkissian. I'm Randall White. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll catch you back here tomorrow with Vicky Gonzalez.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause. And rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.